Blog Talk Radio.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Welcome to the NAAEA Community Conversations. It's main man Marvin Rohn along with Brother George. Part 8 of What Slavery Did to Us. We're going to be talking about World War II through the Korean War. Again, it's a history that's ours and ours alone. And Brother George, we're bringing it to you live. So hang on. Oh. There is no other way to love but to love yourself and kind. You can love yourself and kind and know who you are and what you're all about, then you're on the right path. It's the NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George, and we're talking about our history and what slavery did to us and the ramifications that slavery looks like and continues to appear in our community. And so we're going to do a chronological study of slavery and the impact of it and our adaptation to this experience here in this culture. So we're going to talk about the NAAEA briefly. And the mission of the National African American Empowerment Association is to ensure that the needs of the African American community are met through the development of programs and services that educate, inspire, motivate, and empower the African American community to learn more about who we are and about what we need to do to improve ourselves so we and our children may compete on the highest level possible in humanity. And so we're talking about politics, economics, athletics, which is health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, culture, and education. And we want to be able to improve ourselves in those areas. And so support the NAAEA. Go out to our website. Join us at NAAEA.Weebly.com. Become a member. Tell your children and your family members about it. Also, we have Empowerment Saturday each Saturday with a candid conversation about African American issues and about our community and what we need to do. And so it is up to us people to do the work of working on ourselves. Now I bring in my good friend, George. Brother George, are you available?
Yes, sir, I am. And I would like to say peace and blessings to the listening audience, and I really appreciate what y'all have done as far as supporting the community conversation. And what I'm going to speak about first is Willie Lynch. I'm going to do a little piece on the impact that Willie Lynch still has on us today. And I try to do that at the beginning of all of our sessions. The dysfunctional family is a chronic condition that has been passed down from generation to generation. It has its roots in the deliberate separation of black families during the slave era in both the North and the South. Although the origin of the Willie Lynch myth of slave repression remain unknown, ironically, nearly every social ill in the African-American community can be traced back to some aspect of this system presented in Virginia in 1712. The American institution of slavery was very scientific in its destruction of a people for the purpose of creating a permanent labor force. But not only have African Americans suffered as a result of slavery, the soul of white America was also destroyed in the process of upholding an evil system that condoned the making of men into mindless beasts. After building its great empires on the strength of unified family and community within African languages and customs are constant reinforcements of the system of respect given to elders and the importance of strengthening the family ties. These two strong cultural values have to be destroyed in order for slavery to survive. It is known that the breakup of the family and the separation of tribes and clans who spoke the same language was essential for the prevention of organized uprisings. The separation of babies from their mothers and fathers at an early age was also a deliberate, systematic means of ensuring that the next generation would be ignorant children who were emotionally disconnected from their foreparents. This tragic condition continues to exist today in African American communities.
Thank you, brother. We need to understand the impact that slavery and the culture that we've grown up in and the impact that it's had on the black family. We had a system, and we continue to have a system. We need to nurture and develop that cultural system to create those cultural ties that bind us. And once we get back to that, we'll be fine. Now, lastly, family is important. We have to get back to understanding how important family is with the NAAE as culture and education. Let's understand the importance of culture. Brother George, let's talk about President Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Yes, sir. Well, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the president that came in to resolve the issues of the Great Depression. And as I spoke about him in the last chapter, he came up with a program called the New Deal, which was a job-creating program. Probably he did a lot of the things that could be a blueprint for what president is going to have to do in this country. But just to speak on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt was in his second term as governor of New York when he was elected as the nation's 32nd president in 1932. With the country mired in the depths of the Great Depression, Roosevelt immediately acted to restore public confidence, proclaiming a bank holiday and speaking directly to the public in a series of radio broadcasts called the Fireside Chats. And from that time on, all the presidents do those Fireside Chats. His ambitious slate of the New Deal programs and reforms refined the role of the federal government, redefined the role of the federal government in the lives of Americans. Reelected by comfortable margins in 1936, 1940, and 1944, FDR led the United States from isolationism to victory over Nazi Germany and its allies in World War II. He spearheaded the successful wartime alliance between Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States. And he laid the groundwork for the post-peace organization that is known as the United Nations. The only American president in history to be elected four times, Roosevelt died in office in April of 1945. Now, Roosevelt's successor came in and he immediately set up the process of making it so a president could serve no more than two terms. That's why you see that no presidents after him have been able to be elected more than twice. And that was set up by him. Now, Roosevelt also, as early as 1937, FDR warned the American public about the dangers posed by hard regimes in Germany, Italy, and Japan. In other words, he was trying to prepare the country that it was possibly a situation where the country was going to go to war again. Because World War One, he had already been in a world war before. So he was looking at Nazi Germany and the fact that they were becoming a threat, not only to the United States, but to the entire world. And so the Allied powers wanted to join together and help to defeat them. Now, Roosevelt increased his support of Great Britain with the passage of the Lend-Lease Act, in March of 1941. And he met with Prime Minister Winston Churchill in August abroad, aboard a battleship anchored off of Canada. And the result of this, and the result of the Atlantic Charter, the two leaders declared the four freedoms on which the post-war should be founded. And that's freedom of speech and expression, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Now, a couple of those are in the Constitution already, but I guess they weren't a worldwide guaranteed thing. On December 8th of 1941, the day after Japan bombed the U.S. Navy base at Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt appeared before a joint session of Congress, which declared war on Japan. Now, why he declared war on Japan first, I've studied this in college and in high school, and one of the things that they said was that the United States actually left Pearl Harbor unattended to so that they could be attacked and it would give them an excuse to get involved with the war, because they didn't have an excuse to declare war on Germany, so they declared war on Japan first.
Thank you, brother. Franklin D. Roosevelt, an excellent example of American leadership. And I dare say that we need that kind of leadership in our country now, but even in our communities, we have to develop leaders that can go out and make a difference in our community. You're listening to NAAEA, Community Conversations with Brother George. It's part 8 of what slavery did to us. And now we'll go to D-Day.
Now, the reason why the title is still What Slavery Did to Us is that we've gotten to a period where we're out of slavery. But if you notice, we're still struggling with the vestiges of slavery. We're still experiencing people trying to treat us as second-class citizens, of depriving us of opportunity. And now you're going to begin to see that even stretched out into our service in the military. But now, what D-Day was D-Day was after the United States got into the war, and the United States and Great Britain and the Soviet Union at the time were allies. That's a funny situation, but they ended up being allies in World War II. And during World War II, from 1939 to 1945, the Battle of Normandy, which lasted from June 1944 to August of 1944, resulted in the Allied liberation of Western Europe from Nazi Germany's control. Codenamed Operation Overlord, the battle began on June 6th of 1944, also known as D-Day, when some 156,000 American, British, and Canadian forces landed on 5 beaches along about a 50-mile stretch of a heavily fortified coast of France's Normandy region. The invasion was one of the largest amphibious military assaults in history, and resulted extensive and required extensive planning. Prior to D-Day, the Allies conducted a large-scale deception campaign designed to mislead the Germans about the intended invasion target. By late August 1944, all of northern France had been liberated, and by the following spring, the Allies had defeated the Germans. The Normandy landing had been called the beginning of the end of the war in Europe. Now, the idea of me talking about Normandy, Germany, and a lot of things that involved a great deal of white in this country, in the wars, we also were a part of what was going on in this country. At every stage of everything that this country goes through, our people went through it also. And so I'm just trying to allow you to understand, like, what your great-great-grandfathers went through and what your great-great-grandmothers went through during different time periods in this country, so that we can see how if you don't do anything different, then history will continue to repeat itself. If you do the same old thing, you're going to keep getting the same old results.
That's right, brother. So know your history. Knowledge is power, and that's what we need right now. More information for our community, more of Brother George's to be able to give information that really stimulates our mind about our history and what we've done. We're part of every step along this process. So when you hear someone say, go back to Africa, I dare say we have this country to build on, right? This is just as much country of ours as it is anyone else's in the world. Remember that this is your country, but you can also decide to do other things as well. Brother George, let's move over to the Holocaust.
I wanted to speak on the Holocaust because I think that, first of all, a lot of our people don't actually know what happened with the Holocaust. I know that they know that it was a lot of Jews that were killed, over 6 million that were killed in one form or another by Nazi Germany. But I wanted to kind of give some background information about the Holocaust. The word Holocaust comes from a Greek word, holos, which means whole, and chaos, and kos, which means burned, meaning that they were burned in holes, in ovens, and they were put in gas chambers. And this was historically used to describe a sacrificial offering burned on an altar. Since 1945, the word has been taken to new and horrible meanings. The ideological and systematic state-sponsored persecution and mass murder of millions of European Jews, as well as millions of others, including gypsies, the intellectually disturbed, and despots, and homosexuals, by the German Nazi regime between 1933 and 1945. To the anti-Semitic Nazi leader, Adolf Hitler, Jews were an inferior race and an alien threat to German racial purity and community. After years of Nazi rule in Germany, during which Jews were consistently persecuted, Hitler's final result, known as the Holocaust, came to fruition under the cover of World War II. With mass killing centers controlled constructed in the concentration camps of occupied Poland, approximately 6 million Jews and 5 million others targeted for racial, political, ideological, and behavioral reasons died in the Holocaust. More than 1 million of those who perished were children. Now, the fact that that Hitler killed a lot of Jews, he also killed a lot of black people also. But that's under a name that we're not familiar with, which is gypsies. So when you say the word gypsy, all you have to do is put an E in front of the G, and then it'll make sense. Egyptians, Egyptians, which was the Egyptians or the black Moors that were left from the days of the Moorish Empire. And also, the reason why he said that the Jews were an inferior race was because the Jews were practicing an African religion, and many of them had been to Africa and then came back to Europe in large numbers. He felt as though that the race mixing that might be that because many of them had expansive features. They look white, but they had large noses and thick lips and things just like African people. And so he knew that in some way they had race mixed with African people. And so he targeted that particular group of whites because he called himself forming a pure, you know, superior thinking, superior race of people. And so the Jews were persecuted, and it was a horrifying time for the Jewish community.
Thank you, brother. Again, knowledge is power. And as our Jewish brothers and sisters say, never again. And so we have to take up that mantle as well and say, hey, never again will we be enslaved. And I think one of the missions that we have to fight for is the eradication of slavery around the planet, because we know what it's like, right? We've had the history of it. And so I think our job is to train, teach, and develop people to understand what humanity is once again. Brother George, let's talk about No Surrender for Japan.
Well, as y'all know, the Axis powers included Japan and Germany. So Germany had been defeated, but Japan said, we're not surrendering. We ain't surrendering under no circumstance whatsoever. You're going to have to just kill every single one of us because we're going to fight to the end. So the United States knew that, and I'm thinking out of their minds, that they were going to have to do something. So on August 6, 1945, during World War II, from 1939 to 1945, an American B-29 bomber dropped the world's first deployed atomic bomb over the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The explosion immediately killed an estimated 80,000 people. 10,000 more died of the radiation exposure, which was days after. 3 days later, a second B-29 dropped another atomic bomb on Nagasaki, killing an estimated 40,000 people. Japan's emperor announced his country's unconditional surrender in World War II in a radio address on August 15th, citing the devastating power of a new and more cruel bomb. In other words, they surrendered after, you know, he really had no choice because they just devastated that country with those two atomic bombs. And the atomic bomb has never been used again since that time, you know, but that was how Japan was basically decimated. But they did recover.
You're listening to part 8 of NEA Community Conversations with Brother George, what slavery did to us. We're talking about from World War II through the Korean War. Right now, let's move over to General Patton's Forgotten Troops.
Now, a lot of us have seen the movie Patton. And in that movie, you see the troops, and most of the troops look, most of the troops appear to be white, you know. But General Patton did have a lot of African-American forces in his army. And what I wanted to do today was there were some soldiers that were interviewed that were a part of General Patton's army, and they described some of the things that took place during that time. African Americans made up over 1 million of the more than 16 million U.S. men and women to serve in World War II. Some of these men served in infantry, artillery, and tank units. As General George S. Patton Jr. swept across France into Germany in his third army were African American combat units. Harry Johns, a veteran of General Patton's army sums up their service. African Americans served in every branch of the service in a mandated, segregated military. These men and women discharged their duties with great pride in the face of blatant discrimination and humiliation. The true story and history of their contributions, both in combat units and in service units, has yet to be included in the complete history of the Allied victory in World War II. These men and women fought with great courage and faith in the promise of America. They did not despair of this. They did not despair of this country, for they believed in it and what it stood for. Now, I'm going to start with Harry Johns himself. I'm going to go through his interview, but first of all, he was born in 1921 in Alliance, Ohio, and he served as a corporal in the 999th Field Artillery Unit. In 1945, there was approximately 240 field artillery battalions in Europe. Approximately 8 of these battalions were composed of African Americans. The 999th Field Artillery was one of these African-American battalions in Patton's Third Army. They manned an 8-inch that could fire about 200 pounds projectile up to 10 miles. In combat, this battalion fired approximately 22,200 rounds. Corporal Harry Johns was a member of the 999th Field Artillery Battalion. Now, this is his story that he was being interviewed. Now, after you were shipped to France, you saw combat throughout this period. And the veteran says, "Oh yes, yes. The whole period I was there." The whole period that I was there, so when we were attached to Patton's army, they began to plan to break the fight at St. Louis is like the place that they wanted to take down that was in France, which was the holdup. Some of this is in like black lingo and the way he's talking. And we, the 999th, fired one of the first artillery barrages at the breakthrough. We called it the breakthrough at St. Louis, France. And we followed Patton all the way through France and all the way through Germany. And at one time, we were in continuous combat for 9 months and 22 days. Man, that's unbelievable. Then he asked him a second question. And so you were constantly on the move then? Always constantly on the move. Yes, we would settle in. I don't really recall how long we stayed in each place. But once we knocked out the resistance once we knocked out the resistance in St. Louis and broke through, and we followed Patton. Oh, I'm sorry. Once we broke through the resistance in front of the troops, then we would move, and then the troops would move. You see, that's the way it worked. Sometimes we stay in a place pretty long, as I recall, because we dig foxholes and fix them up and put logs over them that's where we stayed. So he was explaining, like, how they set up camp. Once they got into a place, they would dig foxholes. They would mostly get the brothers to dig foxholes. And they would put the wooden logs around them so that they could hold the mud from falling in and caving in on the foxholes, because they fought out of those positions a lot of times. And they also slept there and did a lot of other things in the foxholes. Now I'm going to move to the next witness, which is Reverend Howard Gray. Now, Reverend Gray was born in 1924 in Bloomington, Ohio. He served as sergeant in the 3414 Quartermaster Truck Company, also known as the Red Ball Express. The Red Ball Express was started in late August 1944 to supply Patton's tanks with much needed fuel. Patton's army used more than 80,000 gallons of gasoline per day. The Red Ball Express was a series of trucks, 6,000 at its peak, that ran 24 hours a day for nearly 2 months. The route was nearly 400 miles long from St. Louis near Normandy to Patton's army at the front. They delivered hundreds of tons of fuel and supplies to the tank unit. The Red Ball officially ended in November of 1944, but these truck companies continued to haul supplies and men to the front during the winter of 1944, including the Battle of the Bulge. Roughly 75% of the truck drivers were African American. Reverend Gray served as sergeant in the 3414 Quartermaster Truck Company, the Red Ball Express. Interview: what happened at the Battle of the Bulge? Bastogne, the Battle of the Bulge, which was in Bastogne. So we got a call that night. It was cold, and to go up and to get them out of there. He was talking about getting them out of Bastogne. So what was remaining of them anyway? So I took my 12 trucks, and I was one to lead the convoy to Bastogne. When we got to Bastogne, a lieutenant in a Jeep, came out and called me and said, "Sergeant, you stay here and guide these trucks into Bastogne. And when one gets up and gets loaded, then send the next one. And don't leave this post." I said, "Yes, sir." And I stayed there outside of Bastogne, sending one truck in at a time. And when the last truck came, they said, "Come on, Sergeant, you better come on. You know, the Germans are still going to bomb." And I said, "I can't. I had to stick to or I would be killed." In other words, if he didn't, you know, honor what the lieutenant had told him to do, he could be killed for cowardice, for leaving your post. Okay, honest to truth, I had to stay there, and I did for the grace of God. I stayed there until my last truck came out, and I boarded that truck that was Bastogne, and we brought them out of there. What was left? And so that's number two. Now, the third brother was actually in the tank brigade, and his name was Buddy Branch. And Buddy Branch was born in 1925 in Dayton, Ohio, served as a corporal in the 761st Tank Brigade, and he was awarded the Bronze Star. Now, this is his story. This is not his story, but this is what happened. The 761st Tank Brigade was one of the small number of African-American tank units. The 761st was the first group of African-American tankers to reach France, assigned to Patton's Third Army. The 761st saw heavy combat as they moved across France and Germany. Nearly 50 members of the battalion were decorated for bravery in combat. Corporal Buddy Branch was one of them. Now, tell us about your Bronze Star. They're asking him to tell him about, you know, the incident that happened that earned him the Bronze Star. It was in November around town in France. The platoon was ordered to move forward after the infantry arrived. The four tanks stayed on the road because there could be mines in the field. They couldn't leave the main road because they put mines all over the place. And so we sit in the first town, and we sit there waiting. The Germans being dug in like they were, they knocked the first tank out. It was on fire. It was burning. They disabled the first one and blocked the road. The other two were blocked in. So the other two tanks in front of ours, one of them went across a field burning, you know, and he sighed, you know, like he could remember it in his mind. I mean, knowing your men are in there burning is kind of something you'll never forget. And that's why a lot of people don't like talking about the stuff that happened. But the second tank was on fire, and the last one was on fire. And our tank had been hit in the rear, and it jammed and in the rear and pointing in the right direction. That and we didn't know why, but it did. We couldn't turn it, and so approximately knocked the steering out of the tank. And so the tank commander, had been hit with a piece of scrap metal. And I got up and directed driver back the tank around the disabled tank. So he maneuvered his tank and got in back of him. And when I got behind a barn, that's when then I got out and went down to try and help some of the men to get out of the disabled tank that they were in. And for that, I got a Bronze Star. Now, this describes the incident. Buddy V. Branch of the a corporal in infantry, Company B, 761st Tank Brigade. Corporal Branch, after having established covering fire for 17 walking casualties, voluntarily dismounted from his tank and with utter disregard for his personal safety, distinguished himself by courage, bravery in the face of heavy enemy fire. Corporal Branch succeeded in inspecting 6 disabled tanks, aiding in the removal and evacuation of 7 litter cases, which I think he's talking about bodies, the people that were still alive that he helped to get out of there, carrying each one of them approximately 300 yards to shelter while under 88 mm guns, which was probably a machine gun. Mortars, machine guns, and snipers continued to fire upon the disabled tank column for a period of 4.5 hours. Corporal Branch's courage and devotion in the duty in his inspiration to all entered military service during from Dayton, Ohio. And that is the stories of the soldiers that served under General Patton in World War II.
Wow. What an amazing exhibition of commitment and pure courage. Let's look at doing those things in our own community, protecting our babies and our families, and giving our children the proper education and development that they need. Brother George, let's talk about the African-American men and women in World War II.
Well, I talked a little bit about some of them, but when Selective Service and Training Act became national first, you know, peacetime, it established the first draft and pressured President Franklin Roosevelt to allow black men the opportunity to register and serve in integrated regiments. He didn't allow them to serve in the integrated regiments, but what he did do was he allowed black men to participate in getting into the military service. And so despite African-American soldiers' eagerness to fight in World War II, the same Jim Crow discrimination in society was practiced in each branch of military force. The kind of treatment they received by white officers in army bases in the United States was horrendous. The 761st Tank Battalion, and the Tuskegee Airmen. As casualties mounted among white soldiers towards the final year of the war, the military had to utilize African Americans as infantrymen, officers, tankers, and pilots, in addition to remaining invaluable in supply divisions. From August 1944 to November 1944, the Red Ball Express, a unit of mostly black drivers, delivered gasoline, ammunition, food, mechanical parts, and medical supplies to General Patton's 3rd Army in France, driving up to 400 miles on narrow strips in the dark with no headlights to avoid detection by the Germans. The 761st Tank Battalion became the first black division to see ground combat in Europe, joining Patton's 3rd Army in France in November 1944. The men helped liberate 30 towns under Nazi control and spent 183 days in combat, including in the Battle of the Bulge. The Tuskegee Airmen, the all-black fighter pilot group trained at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, escorted bombers over Italy and Sicily, flying 1,600 combat missions and destroying 237 German aircraft on the ground and 37 in the air. Without these crucial roles that black soldiers were playing, the American military wouldn't have been the same fighting force it was, says Delmont, which is a person that's giving their opinion. That was the perspective you see much in the white press. Now, what they were saying about the Air Force, the Tuskegee Airmen, what they did was they flew side by side with the bombers. It's like the ones that would be bombing, like, dropping like 50, 100, 200 bombs, you know. They didn't just go out there by themselves. They needed an escort to make sure that the German planes wouldn't come and blow them up. And so they need those fighters on alongside of them, and that's what a part of the job of the Tuskegee Airmen did. The Army wasn't the only branch. Well, this goes into the women that were in the military at that time. The Army wasn't the only branch where women wanted to serve, and other women's units were established. Women who wanted to help the Navy join the waves. The Coast Guard had the SPAR, and the Air Force had the WASP. The Marine Corps had the WR. The WAC, however, was the only branch to allow black women from its inception. Despite this fact, recruitment of black women proved difficult. Segregation meant many black women didn't want to join, and black WACs still faced discrimination. The black press pool helped monitor and speak out against discrimination in the military, including within the WACs. Reports came out that black WACs with college degrees were being assigned to cleaning floors and giving laundry duty. The press demanded a black woman to be assigned to the WACs director of office to monitor and address discrimination complaints. So they wanted to put a person in place that could oversee, you know, the discrimination that was going on, because, I mean, it was at a horrible level. You go to college and get a degree, and then they make you scrub floors. You know, they could have used us a lot better than that. Now, one of the impact people that helped change things for African-American women in the military was FDR's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt intervened on their behalf. And the War Department directed commanders to accept African-American WACs because they changed the name from the WAA to the WAC. And so the 6888th Central Postal Directory Battalion was a unit of more than 800 black WACs and was the only black WAC unit to serve overseas. They arrived in England in February of 1945 with the task of working through a huge backlog of mail meant for the troops. General Eisenhower wanted this mail to be delivered as a means of helping the morale of the troops. When the WACs arrived, they found a building stacked to the ceiling with mail bags and other packages of some spoiled foods and gifts, along with rodents, with rats and different stuff like that. Now, they assigned a commander over that group, and her name was Charity Adams, one of the only two black WACs promoted to the rank of major during World War II, was the commander of this unit. She was proud of the work of her unit did, performing their task in record time. Working in three shifts around the clock, they were able to sort all of the mail in half the amount of time that was expected, in just 3 months instead of 6 months. Every eight-hour shift averaged more than 65,000 pieces of mail sorted. One finished in Birmingham. The unit went to Rouge, France, and ultimately to Paris.
Wow, an extensive history. You're listening to NAA, Community Conversations with Brother George, Part 8 of What Slavery Did to Us. We're talking about everything that happened between World War II and the Korean War. Now that brings us to the Tuskegee Airmen. What do you have, brother?
Well, my impression of the Tuskegee Airmen in the beginning was that it was like this, about 10 pilots that, you know, that they flew in the Red Tails, which was the fighters that they flew in, but I was wrong. And so the Tuskegee Airmen were the first black military aviators in the United States Air Corps. They didn't call the Air Force that at first. A precursor of the United States Air Force. trained at the Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama, they flew more than 15,000 individual sorties in Europe and North Africa during World War II. Their impressive performance earned them more than 150 distinguished flying crosses and helped encourage the eventual integration of the United States Armed Forces. The Tuskegee Airmen, like I said, they were trained in Tuskegee, Alabama at the University of Tuskegee, and there were thousands of them that were trained. The Tuskegee Airmen was not just, you know, one. Now, originally, when they were activated in World War II, they were flying these secondhand P-40 planes, which was much slower and harder to maneuver than the German planes. So they probably shot down a lot of the Tuskegee Airmen. In February of 1944, the 100th, the 301st, and the 302nd fighter squadrons arrived in Italy, together with the 99th. These squadrons of black pilots and other personnel made up the new 332nd Fighter Group. After this transfer, the pilots of the 332nd began flying P-51 Mustangs, which was a much faster plane, to escort the heavy bombers of the 15th Air Force during raids deep into enemy territory. The tails of the planes were painted red for identification purposes, earning them the enduring nickname, the Red Tails. By the time the 332nd flew its last combat mission on April 26th in 1945, 2 weeks before the Germans surrendered, the Tuskegee Airmen had flown more than 15,000 sorties over 2 years in combat. They had destroyed or damaged 36 German planes in the air and 237 on the ground, as well as nearly 1,000 rail cars and transportation vehicles and a German destroyer. In all, 66 Tuskegee-trained aviators were killed in action during World War II, while another 32 were captured as POWs after being shot down. A number of the original Tuskegee Airmen would go on to long careers in the military, including Davis, who would become the first black general in the United States Air Force. George Spank Roberts, who became the first black commander of the racially integrated Air Force unit before retiring as a colonel, and Daniel Chappie James Jr., who would become the nation's first black four-star general in 1975. Now, a lot of what took place with the Tuskegee Airmen in destroying, see, like when you're in a fighter plane, you also are destroying the trains, because they're carrying materials for the enemy. And so, I mean, they was on a lot of different types of runs. And they also said that they shot down 36 German planes. So 36 planes is a lot for one unit to shoot down. So that's the Tuskegee Airmen, y'all.
All right. Our final segment today is the Korean War, and let's look at African Americans in the Korean War.
Okay, the Korean War began on June of 1950, and the way that the Korean War came about was when General MacArthur eventually defeated Japan. A part of Japan's empire was Korea. And so what they did was, because the United States had won policy and Russia had another, they split Korea in half. And so the Russians took North Korea and the United States took South Korea. Now, what started the Korean War was when North Korea tried to completely take South Korea. And so the United States got involved with the war. And so eventually MacArthur used a tactic that Hannibal Barker had used against the Roman Empire. He attacked from the rear to force the North Koreans to pull back across the 38th parallel. And so he eventually, once he got them back into North Korea, all they did was just held that same DMZ that exists today. You know, the same DMZ is there, the demilitarized zone. Now, when you talk about African Americans in the Korean War, Thurgood Marshall recalled that General MacArthur, who was believed that African Americans were inferior to whites, was the greatest impediment to the desegregation of the military at that time. And so he was fired by Harry Truman, who came in and segregated and integrated the military, put Matthew Ridgway in to take over. So basically, blacks had struggled and went through trying times with the during the Korean War, the same way that they did with World War II. So basically, that's what happened from 1930 up into the 1950s, and I'll be going into the Civil Rights Era on the next go around.
There you have it. Thank you, Brother George, for a wonderful history that we all should know and learn, our great accomplishments. Our people have done a great job of serving this country and being a part of this NAAEA Community Conversations with Brother George, Part 8 of What Slavery Did to Us. Join us next time. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you, Brother George. Peace.
It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming. But I know a change gon' come. Oh.